From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actress Jamie Lee Curtis tells us about growing up the daughter of movie stars Janet Leigh and Tony Curtis, then becoming an actress herself. Also today, Tim O'Brien doesn't seek out war movies or war novels, but he can't stop himself from telling war stories. His Vietnam novel Going After Cacciato won a National Book Award. Coming up, we talk about his new book of Vietnam stories, The Things They Carried. And John Leonard reviews a new book about Atlantis by paleontologist and astrobiologist Charles Pellegrino. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Eyewitnesses in the Liberian capital of Monrovia are reporting that government troops have massacred hundreds of refugees who'd sought shelter at a Lutheran church. President Samuel Doe is denying involvement by his troops, insisting instead that the attack on civilians was carried out by rebel troops wearing government uniforms. The BBC's Elizabeth Blunt reports.
Eyewitnesses who visited St. Peter's Lutheran Church after the night's killings described a scene of total horror, with bodies hanging from the windows of the buildings. Women lay dead, their heads smashed open, and their babies still tied to their backs. Diplomats also reported that there'd been an attempt to break into another refugee center during the night at a technical college run by Brothers of the Salesian Order, but that the soldiers were finally persuaded to leave by the priests in charge. The extreme brutality of the soldiers' actions is a measure of the desperation and panic now felt by some members of the army. The rebels have been fighting their way street by street up to President Doe's last stronghold in the executive mansion. Reports say that the mansion has no more fuel or water and no means of resupply.
The BBC's Elizabeth Blunt reporting. A spokesman for the government of Trinidad and Tobago said today that an end to the Caribbean nation's hostage crisis appears to be imminent. A Muslim rebel group has held Prime Minister Ray Robinson and his cabinet hostage in the Parliament building in Port of Spain since Friday. Under the proposed agreement, the official said the hostages would be released unharmed and the rebels would be allowed to return to their encampment near Port of Spain. Native Americans protested in front of the Canadian Embassy in Washington, D.C. today. The demonstration was to show solidarity with Canadian Mohawks in Quebec who were involved in an armed standoff over tribal land claims. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Indians are a sovereign people!
Members of the American Indian Movement marched with signs and beat ceremonial drums in front of the embassy today, yelling, "Negotiate, don't escalate." Doc Aguia, a Mohawk who lives in Washington, D.C., says pressure must be put on the Canadian government.
Because we see a hopeless situation. We don't see any negotiating going on. All we see is starvation tactics happening right now. And the possibility of one infiltrator, and we've got a bloodbath.
Mohawk Indians living on the Oka Reservation just west of Montreal have been locked in a land dispute with the Canadian government since July 11th when Quebec police stormed Mohawk barricades. The roadblocks were erected to protest the expansion of a golf course on land Mohawks claim as ancestral territory. The provincial government made an offer Friday to withdraw police if the Mohawks surrender their arms. The government has also announced plans to purchase the disputed land. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained 19 points today to close at 2,917. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was a time when she was known as the Queen of Scream, and after Halloween, Terror Train, and Prom Night, some people wondered if Jamie Lee Curtis would ever break out of horror films. But the comedies Trading Places and A Fish Called Wanda took care of that. TV audiences know her from the sitcom Anything But Love, and she starred in the thriller Blue Steel, which has just been released on home video. Jamie Lee Curtis grew up surrounded by movie stars. Her mother is Janet Leigh, who starred in Psycho, The Manchurian Candidate, and Touch of Evil. Jamie's father, Tony Curtis, starred in Some Like It Hot, The Sweet Smell of Success, and Spartacus. Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh separated when Jamie was three. She grew up with her mother. Jamie Lee Curtis and comic Richard Lewis can now be seen in reruns of the ABC sitcom Anything But Love. It will return with new episodes as a mid-season replacement. Lewis plays an erotic hypochondriac, not unlike the character he created for his stand-up routine. Lewis is a comic, Curtis is an actress. I wondered if that made a difference in how they each approach their characters.
I really think that although Richard being a stand-up and having a very definitive personality, I actually believe he's playing very much a character. And Richard never improvises on our show. That's not an opportunity that he's had. These scripts are all scripted. And, you know, they've taken his energy as a performer and I think channeled it into a TV character very well.
How are you both matched up?
Oh, in the original pilot of Anything But Love that we did that did not sell, I was signed up originally, and there were two men in the show. And we, you know, auditioned many, 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 many hundreds of people. And Richard came in. He was on my list of maybe five. And I had never really seen him work. I had seen, like, 2 minutes of an act on a cable show and had seen photographs of him and had just got a feeling from him that I thought we would work very well together. And he came in and was so funny in the audition that he was, out of anyone who came in, the only person who really made me laugh and just relax with them. You know, everybody else, it was like, here we are acting together, and he just let me react with him, and it was so clear that we had something.
You've described your childhood, growing up in the Hollywood area, as growing up with royalty. How would you compare the kind of Hollywood experience with, you know, growing up with your mother, Janet Leigh, who was a Hollywood star? How did that compare to royalty?
First of all, any recollection or point that I make about my childhood, you know, is always made from a retrospective position. It's being made as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
As an adult, I look back on my childhood and imagine that when you have famous parents, particularly Hollywood celebrities who are risen above a status, because they're bigger than life on the movie screen, they were both beautifully, physically beautiful people, very talented, and the public loved them so. There is a royal sense. I remember going to Disneyland and having one of those VIP tours. You know, I never had to stand in a line. It was just that part of my life. It was when I was a child, I didn't remember this. It wasn't like as a child I thought I was a little princess. And as a child, I was a normal kid. I had a great time. She wasn't like walking around. I'm saying that the perception of my parents was that they were. My mother raised us in a rural area of Los Angeles, almost a countryfied atmosphere, up a dirt road with a donkey outside our house in a corral. I mean, we lived in the country. We were raised a very natural existence in California, but certainly not a glitzy glamo one, which is not something my mother adopted as a personal lifestyle at all.
Did the studios do any publicity around your birth? And if so, I was wondering if you read the articles or saw news clips when you were older.
Well, certainly now, in retrospect, I have many of these funny old Life magazines and photo plays. You know, people have told me all my life, I remember when you were born. And it's not something that I walk around going, a lot of people know when I was born. it's hard to talk about this because I really want to impart that this is not something that I think about. It's not something that I apply to my life or my daily life ever. It is a fact that this happened. And yes, my parents were huge stars at the time, and my birth was a big deal to a lot of people.
Were there any fantasies that were made up about your family at around the time of your birth? I mean, looking back, can you separate fact from fiction? The Hollywood publicity offices were really famous for just constructing lives that would be glamorous, you know, for making things up about their stars.
I read these things, and I don't believe that one word is attributed directly to my parents.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was made up. I think every single word was made up. Or they would take the fact of that Janet and Tony were married and they had a baby and, you know, our life is blessed by our baby Kelly or, I truly believe that it was just manipulated, which was nobody wanted to know about the sort of downside. You know, now it's very cool and couth. For public figures to sort of come clean with their personal lives. But then I think it was just that sort of manipulation of what people wanted to hear.
What was the downside when
you
were young?
Well, you know, my mother has written in her autobiography, she had been married twice before she met my father. And she was so afraid that someone would uncover this early marriage and make it, you know, a tawdry tale. I'm sure there was unhappiness in my family toward the end of their marriage. I mean, they divorced 10 years, you know, they divorced 10 years after they were married, but they both remarried immediately. So you can only assume that their marriage was crumbling for many years prior to their divorce. That must have been difficult. I don't know. It's not something I've really ever spoken about. It was not a pretty thing. I'm sure it was very difficult. And if you have any personal problems or any personal traumas that go on in your life, whatever they are, and certainly should not be brought up today, but nowadays it's very common for people to come to speak of those and to talk about how they affected the person now. Then I think people didn't discuss anything. And I think it led to a lot of alcoholism and, you know, a lot of problems in people in the 50s. I mean, I think I'm talking about a generational thing, not only in Hollywood. I think it was just not the time that you talked about all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it only was personified more in Hollywood.
You're a mother now. Your daughter is two or three?
My daughter's three. Three and a bit.
What are you doing as mother to... I imagine you want to give your daughter as much of a, quote, normal upbringing as possible, because you felt that you were brought up in this, you know, like, royal...
No.
that people saw you as royalty.
Yeah, please understand
I really do understand. But it's a feeling I figure you might not want to impose on your daughter.
My husband and I both are fairly private people, my husband being a very private person. And I choose to live a normal life, as really normal as I can live. And my big attempt with my daughter, besides just helping her create a real sense of herself, so that if someone does want to know her because she's my daughter particularly, that won't face her, that she will know that she has a very unique and very individual personality, which she does just naturally on her own. She's just a spark of a child. I will never subject her to any of the publicity side of my business. That's a choice that my husband and I have made very consciously. If I'm being photographed in my home, my daughter will not be in the pictures with me. If I'm on Entertainment Tonight, she won't come scampering in the room. You won't see pictures of us on the cover of Good Housekeeping. I'm going to try very hard to keep her separate from that at all costs, so that she can make the choice when she chooses if she wants to do that. If when she is a choice-making young adult and chooses to pose in a picture with me, fine. But I want it to be her choice and not one that I impart on her.
My guest is Jamie Lee Curtis. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jamie Lee Curtis. I spoke with her when the police thriller Blue Steel opened in theaters. It's now out on home video. In Blue Steel, Curtis plays a rookie cop who's tracking down a psychopathic serial killer. I asked her what was new for her in this role.
Well, I hadn't done a lead in a film in a long time. It certainly is a very passive character in a very action film, which for me was a real challenge. The whole role for me was a reactionary one. You've seen the film, I assume.
Yes.
Everything happens to her. She very rarely instigates what happens to her until the end of the film, when she realizes that that is her only avenue. And that's a very challenging thing to do, to try to impart a performance in a reactionary mode. to try to stay clear of any preconceived notions of what's about to happen in the film or what's about to happen in her life, mm-hmm. and just be pure in her in the reactions. It was a big challenge.
Did you have to learn how to handle a gun for this one?
Yes, I'd never fired a gun before. I'd played Annie Oakley in one of Shelley Duvall's Tall Tales, which required me in 6 days to look pretend that I knew what I was doing, which was pretty insane. I'd never fired a real gun before, and wanted very much to be able to fit the requirements of the technical side of the role, and needed to do that by going into, you know, a little bit of background work, and also basically going to a shooting range and learning how to fire a gun. And I learned how to do that. I went in L.A. a little bit. Catherine very much wanted me not to spend a lot of time with police officers in Los Angeles, and wanted me to be able to concentrate on NYPD. And I did that. I came here, hung out with a couple people, and went to a shooting range often, every day, a couple hours a day. And it became a sport after I tried to deal with, once the first time you have a gun in your hand, you deal very much with the moral issue of guns and the power of the weapon and how you own your own personal feelings about guns and gun control. And then after you sort of get over this catharsis and this sort of very emotional moment that I really did have, it became a sport, and it just became target shooting. And then you try to, like in any sport, get competitive, and you try to finesse it so that you could get a better score.
Jamie Lee Curtis is my guest. I know when I was growing up, I had so many fantasies that were based on movies that I'd seen. And I'm thinking that when
you... Tell us a few. We want to know.
Never.
We here in America want to know.
But I'm thinking when you were growing up,
was Tyrone Power and a pair of jodhpurs anything to do with those?
But your parents were in the movies, and unlike my parents, and all of their friends were the movie stars. So I was wondering if the movies, like... were they a part of your fantasy life, or did they just seem like what the parents do when they go to work?
No, unfortunately, one of my saddest feelings about being raised in Hollywood, if there really is something that I consciously, as an adult, look back on and think I wish I could have changed it, because I saw and knew movies, the magic is broken for me. And I was never, as a child, like I'm sure so many people who are not from the movie industry, are enamored by films and have a really romantic, powerful relationship with going to movies. Many people talk about, particularly filmmakers and actors, talk about all their lives going to the cinema, all their lives being taken to movies and watching. And I just didn't have that. Although I was shown films, they did not impart a magical quality to me. It was more just a very sort of cutthroat, this is the movie, but da-da-da-da-da. And I wish I had that sort of magical dream of being in the movies, that people sit back in that dark theater and think, I'll be up there someday. I didn't have that fantasy.
Since, you know, growing up in Hollywood, movies were so work-related to you, when did you decide you wanted to act yourself?
Well, again, growing up in Hollywood, you know, they were work-related in the sense that my mom and dad did them, and I would go and hang out on the set on occasion. You know, I was in school most of the time, so you don't go hang out very much. And again, I don't have any recollection of when it was I decided to do it. It just was, you know, really by chance that it happened that I'm an actress today, because a tennis teacher I knew was sort of turned into a quasi-manager, and he wanted me to go up for Nancy Drew, which I didn't get, but I guess there was interest in who this little girl was. I was in college at the time and ended up in California on a month's break and did an independent study on just sort of how to break into show business. And I ended up signing a contract with Universal Studios for right at the end of that month, right before I was supposed to go back to college, and never went back.
This is Universal TV?
Well, at the time, it was Universal. Well, I mean, it was MCA Universal. They were the last studio to still have a contract system, very much like my parents. I mean, the ironic thing that, in fact, nobody's brought up very much, and I find interesting, is that both my parents were contract players when they first started acting. They were young people. My mother was discovered, literally discovered. My father was in New York. He was discovered, brought out to Hollywood. both of them grew up on the studio system. And in fact, I was one of the last actresses in the world to be under contract. Literally 7-year, 6-month option, their option contract, where I got paid $235 a week. And they disbanded the contract system about 3 years into my contract. But I did. They farmed me out to do Halloween. They lent me out. I mean, it was a real contract system. Sharon Gless, mm-hmm. myself, Delta Burke was under contract at some point. Andrew Stevens.
Were you groomed to be a certain kind of actress by Universal? Because you know, in the contract system, you were often groomed to be a certain type for certain types of roles.
No, one of the reasons I think the contract system disbanded was at one point Universal had like a monopoly on primetime television. And so it was very convenient for them to have sort of a crop of young actors that they could still had to audition for parts, but they were paying them a fairly small amount of money and giving them experience. And the hope of the contract system always is that you're going to groom a young star, that one of these times you give this person a part, it becomes huge, you've got this person under contract for no money, and you basically have a very hot commodity, which you're not paying a lot of money to and you're making a lot of money on. The problem with the current contract system that finally disbanded was that they never took it that final step. They never had the material or the bravery to sort of give one of these contract actors the big break. They just never had the guts to go with a contract actor. They always went with like some other person from the outside. And so they really disbanded it. Whereas in my parents' generation, you know, they did, and they also, in my parents' generation, there were acting teachers afforded to these contract players. They taught you how to dress and makeup, and they groomed you in as either a, you know, the fresh country girl or the femme fatale or whatever. There was no support given to these contract actors except a paycheck every week and the knowledge that they would get a good shot at getting some episodic television. That was it. So I think another reason it disbanded is it just wasn't, in a modern society, it's just not feasible to have that.
So what did you get? What kind of roles did you get in the 3 years that you had this contract?
Well, I did two lines on Quincy was my first job. Then I did an emergency. Then I played a biker chick on Nancy Drew. Then I did one other show there, and I can't remember what it was. And then I did the pilot for a series at Universal called Operation Petticoat, which during the shooting of the pilot, it was a 2-hour movie of the week that was a backdoor pilot is what they call it. And in the middle of shooting that 2-hour movie of the week, we got picked up as a series. So all of a sudden, I was on a series for a year, Operation Petticoat, 1978.
So Universal Studio loaned you out to do Halloween. How did you get the part of Halloween? It was your first. It was your first movie, wasn't it? Starring role in a movie, anyways.
Oh, certainly. It was an audition. Like, you know, when you're a young actor, you audition every day, and it was just another audition. I just went in and read for John Carpenter and then came back and read again and then came back and read again and got the part.
I know Halloween was considered the first in the slasher films and everything, but really you were the kind of heroine in it who was important because you weren't the passive victim. You were being stalked by the psychotic killer and you were fighting back and you won. And that was kind of a breakthrough in a lot of ways, really. Were you aware of that at the time?
I was aware that I was very glad that I was upholding the strength of women. I also was playing women with intelligence. Mm-hmm. I was playing the high school brain. I was playing what we all hope are the good virtues of young women. You know, women who are intelligent, who read, who study, who are good friends. I mean, I really believed, even though I was being slammed up against the wall by the women's groups, that I was in these what seemed to be exploitation films, I was not being exploited. I felt I was upholding very, you know, I mean, in the context of real life, we're talking about a horror movie. But in it, since it was my only job and I was a young woman, I felt I was holding up the real, you know, the best that I could be as a woman in those films. I certainly was never playing the slut or the little tease or any of those that would be easily exploitable parts. I was playing the good girls, and I was very happy to have that role.
Two of the movies you're best known for, Trading Places and A Fish Called Wanda, are comedies. Did you have to learn how to get the timing for a comedy, or did that just come naturally to you?
I've been sort of ham-like a lot, and I guess I've had a dormant comedic background without really ever having the guts to say I did. I think to say that you kind of want to do comedy is a very bold statement. It almost imparts a confidence in yourself as a comedian, and I didn't have that. And so it was sort of a, you know, I needed John Landis to come and say, you know, you should audition for this movie. I also was playing fairly straight characters in both those films. If you look back at those films, you know, I am not the yuckster in there. I'm pretty much a very straight character in a funny film, and I've learned more than anything I've learned on my show, how to relax, how to work on my timing, how to redo timing if I've done it well in the, earlier in the week and then sort of lose it by the end of the week. I try to come up with techniques to help me get back to a certain timing that I liked better on a line or something. But I've certainly learned a lot more doing my show.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this.
Jamie Lee Curtis. Her TV series, Anything But Love, is now in reruns and will return with new episodes as a mid-season replacement. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, journalist Frederick Dannen, his book Hitmen, looks into the new kind of payola in the rock music industry. And in 2 days, we'll have a concert with the rhythm and blues group The Holmes Brothers. Here's a preview of what we'll be hearing. It's from their album In the Spirit. This is Please Don't Hurt Me.
Please don't hurt me. I know I was wrong. Darling, please don't hurt me. Come on.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Tim O'Brien says he's not obsessed with the Vietnam War, but he is obsessed with the stories veterans tell about the war. Those stories inspired O'Brien's novel Going After Cacciato, which won a National Book Award. And they were the inspiration for his latest novel, The Things They Carried. Coming up, Tim O'Brien tells us what he carried while he was in Vietnam. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Unearthing Atlantis by paleontologist Charles Pellegrino. It's about the excavation of an ancient city that may have been Atlantis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The head of the Resolution Trust Corporation, William Seedman, says that Congress needs to authorize another $100 billion to keep the thrift industry cleanup going in 1991. NPR's John Idsty reports.
Seedman, who heads the government's effort to clean up the SNL mess, told members of the House Banking Committee that in the past year the RTC has shut down 211 failed thrifts. But in doing so, it has also spent most of the $50 billion the Congress authorized for the SNL cleanup last year. By December, Seedman said, the cleanup effort will run out of funds, and there are still hundreds of thrifts to be closed. Congress had hoped the original $50 billion would cover the total cost of the cleanup, but it became clear months ago that it wouldn't. Seedman said today that about half of the $100 billion he requested should be recovered when the government sells off the assets of the thrifts it takes over. Still, the request is just for the next fiscal year, and it's certain that more will be required for the cleanup in years to come. I'm John Idsty in Washington.
What appeared to be an agreement between the government of Trinidad and Muslim rebels to end a three-day standoff is said now to have broken down. According to a military spokesman, the government has turned down rebel demands that would have led to the release of the prime minister and other hostages. Last Friday, the insurgents took the hostages when they captured the parliament building and the state television station in Port of Spain. In Washington, GOP congressional leaders say the Democrats are backing away from a deal to present formal proposals on how to cut the federal budget deficit. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more on the story.
After meeting with the president, Republican lawmakers challenged the Democrats to come up with a plan for cutting the budget. Republicans have not yet formally made their own proposal, but have instead floated a plan for higher taxes on beer and wine and a limit on the deductibility of state and local taxes. House Minority Leader Robert Michael says now that the Republican plan is public, it's time to see the Democrats' proposal for cutting the budget.
You haven't written one thing about what they've had because they don't have one. And they were the party that asked that revenues be on the table, and you'd think of all things they'd be the first then to come up with some kind of revenue plan.
The president has not said whether he will ask Congress to remain in session during its August recess until a budget agreement is worked out. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
After a break of 29 years, the Soviet Union and Albania have agreed to restore diplomatic relations. According to news reports, these two countries will develop political, economic, and scientific contacts. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 19 points to close at 2,917.33, volume 145 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. There's nothing unusual these days about seeing the Vietnam War depicted in movies, television, and books. But back when the subject of Vietnam was considered too risky, my guest, novelist Tim O'Brien, was writing about the war. He served in Vietnam in 1968 as an infantryman. In 1973, he published his first book, a memoir, If I Die in a Combat Zone. In 1979, his novel Going After Cacciato became the surprise winner of a National Book Award, beating out John Irving's The World According to Garp and John Cheever's Stories. Cacciato was about a soldier who decides he's had enough of the war and takes off for Paris. The novel mixed poetic realism and comic fantasy. O'Brien's new book is The Things They Carried, a collection of Vietnam stories tied together by a fictional narrator whose name is also Tim O'Brien. I asked O'Brien to read from the book. In this passage, the narrator is reading a 17-page disjointed letter in which his former combat buddy writes about the problem of finding a meaningful life after the war.
I felt it coming, and near the end of the letter it came. He explained that he had read my first book, If I Die in a Combat Zone, which he liked except for the bleeding heart political parts. For half a page, he talked about how much the book had meant to him, how it brought back all kinds of memories, the Vills and Paddies and Rivers, and how he recognized most of the characters, including himself, even though almost all the names were changed. Then Bowker came straight out with it. What you should do, Tim, is write a story about a guy who feels like he got zapped over in that shithole. A guy who can't get his act together and just drives around town all day and can't think of any damn place to go and doesn't know how to get there anyway. The guy wants to talk about it, but he can't. If you want, you can use the stuff in this letter, but not my real name, okay? I'd write it myself, except I can't find any words, if you know what I mean. And I can't figure out what exactly to say. Something about the field that night, the way Kiowa just disappeared into the crud. You were there. You can tell it.
Has anything like that actually ever happened to you, getting a letter from a friend or having a friend say to you, you've got to tell my story, I can't do it, but you've got to tell it?
Oh, it's happened hundreds and hundreds of times. I've never taken them up on the offer, and even in this case I didn't. The letter is made up.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that people almost define themselves by maybe a half dozen or a dozen stories that describe the pivotal incidents in their life?
I do. In my own life, you know, I would say there are a handful, maybe a dozen incidents that are like touchstones that recur over and over in my fiction. There's one incident in the book, in my new book, about the shooting of a baby water buffalo in Vietnam. And the image of a defenseless water buffalo being shot over and over and over again is one that has appeared in, I think, everything I've written, or close to everything I've written. I'm not sure, you know, what the image is there for in terms of symbol or metaphor. Probably nothing. It just has the feel of meat, which was the feel of war. Flesh and blood. Poor baby buffalo being shot over and over and over again. That's a senseless, you know, that's war.
Well, in the novel, the person who's shooting the buffalo, the water buffalo, is doing it after he's seen a friend of his die. You know,
yes.
one of his buddies die, and this is interpreted as a kind of, not exactly revenge, but venting, some kind of venting of the frustration. Did you witness something like this? Is that why the image keeps recurring in your fiction?
Yeah, I did. I witnessed, we were walking along a paddy dike one day after a horrible a few hours in a village adjacent to the village of My Lai where the massacre happened. We lost several fellows who'd hit landmines. And the platoon was lined up in a long, long row across the paddy dike, and 100 yards away stood a water buffalo. And with no signal, the men began firing. And the buffalo stood there, and you could see gobs of flesh, you know, jumping off the beast. And it stuck.
Were you one of the men who fired?
No. I watched dumbly. I understood it. You can't justify something like that, but there was no enemy to take it out on. Men were feeling sorrow and rage simultaneously, and the buffalo was there to bear the brunt.
Although the narrator in your new novel, The Things They Carried, has the same name as you do, Tim O'Brien, you make it really clear in subtle ways throughout the book that this narrator is not really you, although you've given him your name. So you're always kind of challenging the reader to say, hey, make this connection between me and the narrator, but keep in mind the narrator isn't me at all. Why are you playing with us like that?
I love to play. Fiction should be fun. The idea came to me an hour or so at the typewriter. Instead of calling my protagonist Ernie or Fred, I typed the word Tim down. And it seemed that this had the possibility, at least, to be fun. Beyond that, it pushed me down inside myself. Although the events in the book are invented, the emotions and the passions of the book are from my heart. And by typing sentences with the word Tim in them. I found myself going down deeper and deeper and deeper into my memories of Vietnam, and coming up with a lot more. This book is the first book I've ever written that seems to me to touch my own heart, and I hope, you know, it'll touch the reader's heart too.
I'm surprised to hear you say it's the first book that's touched your own heart. I mean, your first book was a war memoir. Your second book, the novel Going After Cacciato, was set in Vietnam, and I'm sure that there was a lot of stuff based on your own emotions and memories from the war. Why does this one feel like the first one that really came from the heart?
I think partly because of the use of my own name. Cacciato, although it's my best known work and best liked work to date, feels to me a little cerebral. I'm playing in that book with memory and imagination, basically the things I'm writing about in my new book. But the form of the book, of Cacciato, that is, has an intellectual feel to it, like artifice. Whereas the new one, the stories are simple, tender, I hope. And there's just a quality of, I mean, I read these things aloud as I do at colleges now, and then my voice sometimes it cracks a little. I don't know how to explain it. I just feel it.
Tim O'Brien is my guest. His new novel is called The Things They Carried. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Tim O'Brien is my guest. His first novel, Going After Cacciato, like his new book, was about the war in Vietnam. O'Brien served in Vietnam in 1968. Are you as absorbed in the war in actual life as you are in your fiction?
Not at all. Not at all. The war was 20 years old for me. I don't dream about the war. I never have. I don't think about it. The war comes to me only as material for storytelling. I'm obsessed not by Vietnam, not by war, but I'm obsessed by these stories, some of which, you know, I heard, some of which I invent. But it's the story that intrigues me, and the trying to actualize the story through some decent writing.
How vivid are your memories from the war? I mean, how much do you think you remember of, what, the year that you were there?
Oh, a few scattered images. The way if you were to pick up a photographic album and page through it, you'd maybe 7 or 8 pictures would be, you know, there that would be really vivid, another 24 or so you'd vaguely recollect. The rest of the album is empty. A lot of black pages, which you'd expect, I think, that our memories leave us. But beyond that, a lot of the war was not memorable. Plodding along from village to village, hot days, mosquitoes. It was a kind of monotony to it, but a strange monotony, you know, boredom with a twist.
What was the twist?
The twist was a kind of, like a leaky faucet in your stomach, and instead of water, there was this acid feeling dropping out where you can feel it just eating away inside you. You're bored, frightened simultaneously. Try it sometime. It's tough.
Let me ask you about a couple of the images in the book and see where they come from in actuality or your imagination. I mean, what they signify to you. One of the men in the company, Henry Dobbins, is always wrapping his girlfriend's pantyhose around his head. It's his protective magic, his good luck charm.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot of the men you know have something like that? Did you have anything like that yourself?
No, I didn't carry pantyhose, but there were talsmans that men carried and wore, and the kind of talsmans that touch on peace, that the pantyhose business is wrapped around a fellow's neck as a kind of comforter, is a reminder of all he doesn't have, his girlfriend. piece that that girl represents for him. And, you know, some men carried letters from home, some men carried coins their father made and sent them. A lot of us carried photographs. Some carried lockets of hair.
What were the things that you carried with you to remind you of who you were and what it was that you loved?
I carried odd things. I carried you won't believe this, I carried a book of German grammar. I wanted to learn German while I was in Vietnam.
It seems like such a remote thing
what
to...
what an odd thing to be saying, you know, your Spanish, sprechen Sie Deutsch, and trying to get the accents right and learn the, you know, the grammatical structures of German after, you know, marching all day long through really horrible things. It was a way of, you know, it was a lot of us, you know, pushing the war aside, if even for a few moments.
Well, I guess it was also a way of, like, affirming that you had a life of the mind, that there was more besides, like, your body in the war.
Yeah, that's that. I think that was a great, great part of it, and a way of just touching on civility and civilization, which for me books represented then and continue to represent. I mean, that's what they are.
What else did you carry?
Oh, gee. Oh, I carried so much. I carried cans of orange juice that my father had sent me from Minnesota. These were just precious to me. He sent me 12 cans, and they were heavy. And it wasn't the orange juice I craved. It was the fact that these cans of orange juice had come from my dad from so far away. And I gave myself 1 month for each can. One can a month.
So you measured your whole tour of duty by those cans?
By those cans of orange juice.
Did you ever try to travel light?
Yeah, I mean, eventually you have to. I think you discard things. You discard odd things as a soldier. You discard things like hand grenades and belts of ammunition, the things you think you'd keep. Claymore mines. We were so burdened by stuff that we were like giants lumbering through that countryside, hauling along with us the whole, you know, all those resources of the American war chest.
Your first book, If I Die in a Combat Zone, was really one of the early war memoirs. When did it first come out? Was it 1973?
Yes.
And then Going After Caciato came out a few years later. It was still one of the early Vietnam novels. Was it different for you writing about the war before Vietnam had so penetrated fiction, movies, and television?
I can't say that the output of recent books and movies and so on about the war has helped me or hindered me. I haven't seen many of the movies, and I haven't read many of the books.
I'm surprised to hear that. You'd be curious either to see like what other people were doing with it, or to see if how it compared to your own experiences or your own telling of the experiences.
I think for me at least, I'm not much interested in war stories. Most of them tend to be melodramatic and predictable and bad stories. And I think a lot of readers feel the same. We've been, you know, brought up in too many John Wayne movies and too much bad writing. This isn't true just for Vietnam, of course. It's true for if you look at love stories, look at all those Harlequin romances out there. But nonetheless, there's something about the war story that makes me want to turn my head and move away gently. For me, the war is, that isn't important to me now. What's important to me is language about the war and about the human heart. I was never a very good soldier. I hated that war. And it's now in the distant past. What's in the present for me are the stories that have really, in a way, nothing to do with the war. They're set in the war, but they're stories for me of, you know, friendships and ghosts and girlfriends and that kind of thing.
Another image I want to ask you about, and I wasn't sure whether this was literary or actual. there's a sequence, and it's a pretty pivotal sequence where a couple of the characters in your novel are in a field of sewage, and the smell just won't go away. I mean, long after they've left, the smell just won't go away. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's the literary image there is clear. I was wondering if that was an actual experience too, if there were fields of sewage like this that you got caught in.
Yeah, I mean, it was meant to be a description of actual things and not as metaphor, not as symbol. Just stuff,
I'm really
stuff.
Glad to hear that, by the way.
It was shocking to read it, you know, in some column or review that, you know, this is taken as a metaphor for something. It didn't occur to me as soon as it was written. I thought, oh, my God, you know, I can see it. But it was intended just as stuff, a field full of sewage that we camped in one night. And we were attacked and mortared, and a man went under.
Man went under the sewage.
Yeah, no metaphor, just under.
I'd like to try to explain why it is that I'm almost relieved that it really happened. Do you know what I mean? As something that really happened, it seems quite horrible. As something that would have been metaphor, it would seem like too much.
Yeah, it would have. You know, in a way, it's one of those things where, you know, if I would have, I suppose, thought a little more clearly about it all, I might have avoided it. But, what would I do? How would I change things? You know, I probably wouldn't in the long run. I think if Melville, in writing Moby Dick, thought that whale would be finally just a metaphor, he might have changed it to a tuna fish. Not quite so godlike.
How long did it take before you could wash the sewage off and get out of there?
I never have. It's that smell is still in my dreams. It's the one thing that's really stuck with me. I don't dream Vietnam, but the smell. I don't know if you've ever had an operation that had ether.
Yes,
I did. As a kid.
My tonsils. Getting my tonsils out.
That, you know, that now and then, every 3 years or 8 years, the smell of ether returns to me. It's not set in the hospital. That's a folding feeling in the brain, just a folding over the brain with a smell inside the folds. And that's what returns to me now and then, the smell of that field of sewage folding through my dreams.
What do you think it is that it's the smell that stays with you more than anything else?
That was a pretty terrible smell.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. And part of it is, you know, I'm sure it was linked somehow to the awful thing that happened in the field that night.
Tim O'Brien's new book, The Things They Carried, is published by Houghton Mifflin. This is Fresh Air.
Hi, it's Noah Adams from National Public Radio's All Things Considered. On our program today, fighting at the television station in Trinidad, where the Prime Minister has been taken hostage with demands that he resign. In Monrovia, Liberia, more than 200 refugees said to be massacred, mostly women and children killed by government troops. The government there denies this. Andre Cădrescu continues his reporting from Romania with a visit to his hometown of Sibiu in Transylvania. The occasion is to get together with some of his high school classmates. Also, this story, a Greyhound bus yesterday on Interstate 95 in Maryland. A passenger noticed a stowaway in the bathroom, notified the driver. From that point on, a great deal of confusion. That and more coming up on National Public Radio's All Things Considered.
Critic John Leonard recently came across a new book called Unearthing Atlantis, An Archaeological Odyssey. And when he read it, some old memories resurfaced.
I was in Thera 13 years ago. For the beauty, not the ruins. Thera, or Santorini, is the most beautiful place in the world. The westernmost of the Cycladic Islands, in the middle of the Aegean, off the coast of Greece. You arrive by boat from Crete. By donkey, you climb 1,000 feet straight up. At the top of the cliff is a white and blue town, Byzantine bungalows, an Orthodox church, a black sand beach, and a disco. You are looking at the sun die in a lagoon left over by a volcano. The mind falls, too, down this steep perspective, through modulations of brilliant light, into the prehistorical. Thera is where they have decided Atlantis used to be. Busy as I was, like a goat eating all that beauty, I never went to the ruins, where archaeologists now disinter, fresco by fresco, an underground city. This city was buried in 1628 BC under a blizzard of volcanic ash from a force more powerful than the simultaneous explosion of 150 hydrogen bombs. 50 cubic miles of rock became as a vapor in the heavens. Death rolled into Turkey on the tongue of a tsunami. In Egypt there were plagues, and Minoan civilization vanished, leaving behind an ornamental vase or two and rumors of bull worship. Plato, 13 centuries after the fact, reporting in one of his dialogues some hearsay from Critias the Elder, who heard it from Solon, who'd been among the pharaohs, was right on lots of details about Atlantis, but for the bigger picture we must look to volcanology, glaciology, paleobotany, oceanography, chemistry and particle physics, as well as the Old Testament and classical literature. We must read pottery shards and carbon exhaust clouds, California bristlecone rings and Irish peat bog, ice caps and acid layers, fossil clam beds and dinosaur teeth. On Thera alone, the archaeologists have 300 years of patient work ahead of them. Charles Pellegrino, a paleontologist and astrobiologist, is the perfect man for the big picture. He's equally at home on top of the smoking cathedral of a volcano or underneath the sea, where giant sandworms inhale sulfides and entire continents grind and shift from the pull of the moon on bedrock. He dreams in eons, from last October all the way back to the Big Bang. His is the view from Krakatoa, Pompeii, and Mount St. Helens, from Stonehenge and Glomar, from the Book of Numbers and the Book of the Dead. What he sees through this time gate is a culture of genius, in business for 1,500 years before the roof blew off. In the Minoan world, he says, every island had the Aegean for a moat. Competition was inevitable, universal control virtually impossible. If Thera hadn't exploded, there might have been television by the time of Christ. Instead of television, there was the first navy and the first condo, flush toilets and other technologies we wouldn't recover till the Islamic Empire of the Middle Ages, brave men who hunted bulls with ropes, and beautiful women who drank the blood of those bulls from golden cups, artists who painted dolphins instead of kings. Because of that explosion, the vulgar Greeks took over the Mediterranean, and Moses got out of Egypt, after which, in Palestine, the people of Moses might have met the displaced Thereans and called them Philistines. Never mind. It's a dream of a book, like The Room of the Lilies in the Underground City on Thera. It makes you weep.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Unearthing Atlantis by Charles Pellegrino. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our show is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Frederick Dannon on his new book, Hitmen, an investigation of corruption in the rock music industry. And a talk with Jerry Zucker. He was part of the team that made Airplane and The Naked Gun. He makes his debut as a solo director in the new film Ghost. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.